Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 366. We are the most positive, most exciting, happiest Nintendo podcast you will ever hear. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
Nintendo is great. It's my favorite company by far, and I applaud their efforts.
And Wii U is selling just amazingly well. Mr. Guillaume Veillette is here.
Nintendo will never screw me over the way Microsoft is with this Windows 8.
That's problem. Not in that exact way, you're right. And also James Jones.
So we're making checks we can't cash in the opening segment.
I mean, this is the predictions episode, James.
Yeah.
That's true. It's the theme.
Hey. Last year. Yeah. That's all I said.
We'll get to it. All right, guys. So we do have listener mail coming up later in the show, including our predictions. They're not going to take up the whole segment, but we'll lay out a few dumb speculations for 2014 now that we are well into the new year. And I think this will be a pivotal year for Nintendo. So it'll be interesting to see where we go with those. Not that interesting because we have no idea what we're talking about, but again, people love this shit. I mean, every year we get emails, multiple emails from people saying, hey, I went back and listened to last year and we're really funny. And yeah, and I guess it gives people a chance to throw in their own, which is always worthwhile. First, we do have new business, and John Lindemann has a game that we have not talked about at all on this episode, even on this podcast ever that I can think of, even though it was the highest selling game of the past 2 or 3 months across all platforms.
Well, I know, and you know, our audience has been dying to hear about Call of Duty Ghosts. I realize that.
So, yeah, it's a big winner.
John, the funny thing is, when you mentioned that you'd been playing it, I realized I know nothing about this game. I mean,
dogs.
I know what Call of Duty is, but for this particular Call of Duty, I don't know the theme. I don't know, like, the time period it takes place in, or you know, the story. I guess it's a brand new storyline.
I also don't really know about the game, but that's because I think I'm too good for first-person shooters. But
that's,
please go on.
Yeah. That's a fact. Yeah, so it's kind of as a lot of first-person shooters are doing now, they're kind of in this sort of alternate future storyline sort of thing. Because, you know, actual real wars that have happened in the past have just been done to death
boring.
So much.
Boring as hell.
So that's kind
it's
of
not because
to
they're
be
too controversial or too raw. It's because they're boring.
More like Afghana snooze.
But is this game related to, like, the Modern Warfare series? Because that's also kind of like near future.
Not
does it tie
really.
In?
It's. I think that there might be a couple of small. The only tie-in that I know of, honestly, is that the dog that you control at certain points is named Riley, which ties into one of the characters in the Modern Warfare series. There's like, that's just a small tie.
Sounds like a tip of the hat more than like a real connection. Okay.
You think this was a reference or a nod to Kid Icarus Uprising?
Probably.
Yes.
Definitely, actually.
Okay.
But they made it a reference by giving you a terrible control scheme.
Yeah.
So it's in this alternate future where, you know, kind of the bad guys in this one are it's a combination of South American countries. So Brazil, Chile, and one other South American country. It's not important.
Like those countries in the real world.
They're all the same.
They have formed a massive, you know, coalition, and they attacked the U.S. Because they were. It was something, as the story goes, they were the only ones with oil, and some calamity happened in the oil producing area of the world in, you know, Middle East or whatever, and something happened. And anyways, so pretty much South America attacks the U.S. and the whole thing is kind of at a stalemate right now. So there's, you know, a huge wall that's been erected on the southern borders of the United States, and it's patrolled, and it all started, the attack on the U.S. started off with these South American countries commandeering a space laser or some sort of kind of apparatus like that.
Spazer, we call it.
Yeah, they attacked from orbit, you know, destroyed a whole bunch of cities in the U.S., you know, so everything's kind of cratered out and, you know, there's like all areas, vast areas of wasteland, et cetera, et cetera.
Have Call of Duty stories always been this far-fetched or?
Yeah.
This is pretty standard for them. This is really on the level.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much.
You know, at the first Modern Warfare, I think they set off a nuke in L.A. or something
like
that.
Yeah, it's not good.
The Russians take over Washington, D.C. Yeah, but it's I mean, they're all crazy.
Right, but it's Russians. It's not Brazil. I mean...
Well...
Dude, it is at least as likely that Brazil could take over America as it is Russia right now, okay?
Yeah. Well, it's even less likely that Brazil and Chile would work together because the Pacific versus Atlantic. I'm not, you know what? No, it's not worth it. I'm not turning this into financial corner on NPR. We're not doing it.
Let's just get through this.
You underestimate the ability of hatred for America uniting peoples, James.
No, Chile loves America. They love it.
So, John, I guess my big question for this Call of Duty, because, you know, I'm sure it's not terribly different than other Call of Duties, but how do the ghost powers work? I mean, can you, like, possess bowls of dog food and solve environmental puzzles?
It's a David Cage joint.
Well, you do kind of possess a dog. You can play. There's certain points where you can attack people as the dog, so you can kind of. Apparently, this is actually really done in the army, where they give the dog a harness, and you can kind of like control the dog somehow. I'm not too sure how it's done. It's really not important. It's Call of Duty. Who gives a shit, right?
The dog is trained. The dog is trained to respond to cues, and then the harness gives those
because
cues.
Of science. Yeah,
it's Call of Duty. Science really has no place here.
But... they have a space laser, John.
A spazer.
It's really not. I was expecting it to kind of be used all over the place, but it's kind of used sparingly. And generally, it's kind of like a stealth tactic where you'll take out a guard with the dog. Like you'll send the dog in and you kind of navigate the dog through an area and you'll take out a guard. And, you know, then, you know, you kind of call the dog back.
Can you do it anytime you want, or are those really scripted?
They're kind of, they're not scripted, but you can only do them at certain points in the campaign. Now, the multiplayer kind of mixes things up a bit. The maps are a lot bigger than they are, like, say, in Black Ops 2, because Black Ops 2 is it's kind of like throwing everybody into a small space and
So they're more like Battlefield style?
No, they're just larger. They're not – they aren't large-scale battles like that, even though they do have squads where you can kind of you can take sort of like an AI. Like, so you can control one character, and then you have a bunch of AI – like you have like an 8-person squad, you and 7 kind of AI bots, which is pretty cool. And you can go online and you can play other people and you can get, you know, XP to level up and prestige and all that via that. Or you can do all the normal stuff like team deathmatch and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you have your loadouts and all that kind of stuff. And they have a little bit more soldier customizing stuff in there than in past ones, like in Black Ops 2. Just a lot of different stuff. It has a different feel though from Black Ops 2 for sure. Black Ops 2 is a lot quicker. The maps in this one seem to kind of be more focused on sniping and stuff like that. And I think they're just meant for larger teams of people. It's a little bit different, so I'm kind of still getting used to multiplayer.
That probably works out really well on platforms other than Wii U. I mean, the same with like the weird modes, like the squad mode, like going online with that kind of thing, I think is, you know, potentially super interesting, but anything other than like the main meat and potatoes team deathmatch mode, unfortunately the base of people playing this on a system like Wii U is going to be so small that you'll probably never get a real game going outside of the most basic mode.
Yeah. Actually, I like squads a lot. I'm really glad they added it. Because, you know, I've played other first person shooters where they have sort of this AI thing, but it's just you playing against AI bots, which really isn't that great. But being able to play other people and AI bots, and the AI bots actually aren't bad either. You know, they'll kill you. You know.
Do you know it's an AI when you get hit by one?
No, that's the thing. I really didn't. You know, because that's the thing. Well, there's some good players playing this game, so I'm used to getting, you know, I'm used to people getting the jump on me. So a lot of
getting housed.
I can't tell if it's a bot or not a lot of the time, but. But then again, I haven't played very much of it, so that may become apparent as I get better with the game. But
well, I want to say that most Call of Duty games have not had bots at all.
Yeah, most of them don't.
I don't think that's really a standard feature of that series. I think Halo has them.
Killzone has some of them.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, Killzone does for sure. And, you know, of course, Perfect Dark, we talked about on Retroactive, but that game has really cool bots. You know, you can customize the personalities and stuff. But a lot of modern first-person shooters don't do them, and I think probably because they're hard to program, or they're hard to make realistic, or they're hard to balance. And especially now that things are online, there's also just less of a need for it. I mean, if you can get online, you really shouldn't have that much trouble finding other players. So the old need for bots for like people who mainly played the game by themselves, or they couldn't get enough people together, that's kind of mostly gone away. And now, you know, it's just probably not worth the effort to program that stuff most of the time.
Well, you can tell they had an approach to it, because when you actually, the first time before I actually went online, I wanted to just hop into team deathmatch. And it actually tells you the first time you try to access the online part of it, because it's two separate parts. You can go online, Xbox Live, and then you can play squads. Squads is kind of like it's broken out as its own separate thing. The first time you go in there, and just if you play it without playing squads first, it says, hey, why don't you play squads and kind of, you know, get your feet under you before you go online? Like it actually says that on the screen. It says, you know, we suggest that you play squads before going online just to get accustomed to, you know, ghosts. Playing Ghosts against
other people. Hey, we saw you play the single game.
Well, and there's the last game mode is Extinction, which is kind of like a swarm horde mode where, but it's actually kind of a cool take on it. You're fighting aliens, like, you know, kind of like, you know, four-legged spider kind
illegal
of
aliens.
Aliens. Oh. Yes, James.
Well, I figured with the content material.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool because you have to put down a drill. There's these nests in each area, and you have to put down a drill in front of them, and you have to fend off the aliens as they come to take out the drill. And it just, you know, it goes on and on. More aliens come, the more, you know, each area as you progress, there's more aliens, more nests, stuff like that. So it's actually pretty cool.
I can't recall aliens ever being part of a Call of Duty game before. No,
they've done zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've done zombies. They've done Nazis.
Yeah, this is kind of their answer.
Well, I mean, it started with Nazis, so.
Yeah, this is their answer to the Black Ops zombie mode. It's pretty well done. It's good. Even though, in the campaign will be my first stop on this, my last stop on this trip, I should say. The campaign is interesting. The story is, it's pretty easy to predict. It's not really giving you anything new or doing anything too crazy. But I must say, there was a couple of firsts for me playing this game. For the first time during a cutscene, I actually predicted a line that somebody was going to say before they said it. Word for word.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You've never done that before?
I've never done that before.
Oh, it's the best feeling in the world.
That says more about you than it does about this game.
Especially when the line is really stupid. That's the best feeling in the world.
It was just a predictable kind of like something out of a Michael Bay movie.
Oh,
let's just say, yeah. So, but that was pretty classic.
Does movies have dialogue?
And then the other thing was I predicted the name of a mission before it came up on the screen. And I was just like, wow, this is pretty predictable. It's like, you know, you've
played
a lot.
Was it no Spanish?
No. It was end of the line. it was weird, man. I had this feeling, and it was because I knew it was near the end of the game. It's not the final mission, but it's near the end of the game. And just what they were setting up to do was kind of like, we're going to take out this factory where they're making this satellite kind of thing. And I was like, for some reason, I was just like, this is going to be the final assault. And I was just like, I bet you this is called end of the line. Sure enough, pops up on the screen, end of the line. I'm like, holy shit.
So that happened to me once, John, in Super Mario 64.
Mm-hmm.
In the very last level, you know, where you're on the magic carpets and everything, there's a rainbow up there. And I kept thinking, you know, that rainbow looks close enough that maybe I could actually get to it at some point. And I bet you there's a little mission called Somewhere Over the Rainbow, or just Over the Rainbow. And there is. It's one of the last stars in the game.
Oh, man. Yeah.
It's a really cool mission, too. But
sometimes
it's too easy.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that, though. I was like, wow, really? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the story, the ending is kind of, the ending is like, it's pretty obvious what's going on, and leaves it wide open for a sequel. So, of course, there's going to be a Ghost 2. So, but I mean, I think I'll like it. I mean, I think it's good. I mean, you know, is it going to make you love the franchise? Nah. But I think if you're a fan of the franchise overall,
Ghost 2 takes place entirely during Carnival.
I was really counting on this Call of Duty game to get me into the series, but
maybe next time.
Maybe next time when the next one comes on a Wii U.
Well, yeah, that's a big if. So Ghost is of course on Wii U. And I've heard that the Wii U version of Ghost is fine. That's pretty good. You know, it has all the same features as Black Ops 2, which had really good features. You know, great off TV play and split screen co-op, like real split screen co-op, where one person's on the TV and one's on the gamepad. Some good multiplayer where you can team up locally and both go online as a team and play against each other. So, you know, I'm sure it's quite good. But actually, John, I was just curious for you being a multiplayer fan. Can you feel any difference with the multiplayer community on this game now that PS4 and Xbox One are out and a lot of people have probably moved to playing it on those systems?
No, not really, because I mean, still a lot of people bought the 360 version of it.
Yeah, it's still the best-selling SKU.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. I will say with the campaign, you know, I kind of dogged the campaign, but I will say I did sit down and literally play through it at one stretch, beginning to end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, they are getting shorter and shorter.
Well, it took me 8 hours to beat it, but I sat there and I played through the whole thing. It is very brisk and it's fast paced and pretty fun. And once you get into a groove, I mean, you can just blow through it. So.
Cool. I still think a lot frequently about going back to Black Ops 2 on Wii U and beating the campaign there, because I got maybe like a fourth of the way through it. Just in one evening, and I liked it. I mean, it was crazy, but you know, I was having a good time with it, and it wouldn't take that much longer to get through the rest, but something came along and pulled me away, and that's just how things go. But
its campaign is certainly the probably the best one I've played in the series. Maybe not story wise. The story is kind of hokey again. Alternate.
Yeah, but in the mission variety though, I think
the mission variety is definitely the best.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
Alrighty, well, I will go next with new business, and there's a few things I could talk about. Maybe we'll come back around if there's time, but I guess the main thing I'll talk about this week is Rush, which is an eShop game on Wii U that came out a couple weeks ago, maybe right before the end of the year, and this is a game by Two Tribes. Mm-hmm. So I believe, I didn't do all my homework on this, I apologize, but I believe that this game Rush used to be called Rubik's Cube Rush on Wii.
Yeah. Whoa. It had a retail release as under the Rubik's Cube license, and then it got a WiiWare release without the license, I think.
Oh, okay. I didn't know it had come out on WiiWare. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is an HD eShop game. I think it costs $2. It's one of those that they like Edge, same thing, and then the original Toki Tori. They released all three of those on the Wii U eShop for $2 a piece, and they're all good. I mean, if you've never played them, I would say, hey, you've got very little to lose by picking up these games. I didn't try Toki Tori just because I'd played it before on WiiWare, but certainly Rush and Edge both look really nice in HD. I think they did a nice job of setting those up, and they work well on the gamepad. And in fact, the cool thing about Rush is that, you know, it was originally designed for pointer control on Wii. And so, on the Wii U version, it's all touch based. So it's all touch screen, mm-hmm. which I've played very few Wii U games that rely entirely on the touch screen. It clones the display onto the TV, which is probably mostly useful if you have other people around who kind of want to watch you play. When you're playing it, you really need to look at the gamepad because you're using the touch screen, and it would be hard to play, if you were looking at the TV. The gameplay, it's really a puzzle game. There's no action to it. It's not any kind of platformer like there are other games. But it's all puzzle, and, it's a little bit like, Mario versus DK pipe game that came out on 3DS early last year. Or maybe if you've ever played like Choo Choo Rocket, something like that, you know, it's like a tile game where there's blocks moving around and you just drag, tiles with arrows on them, and the arrows make the blocks change direction. And so you're trying to use that to send the blocks around to the goal line. And the blocks come out automatically. and they don't start until you hit play. So there's no time limit or anything. You open up a level, you look at it, kind of figure out how it's laid out, and then you just start pulling over tiles, and you can even trial and error. I mean, you can throw tiles down, hit play, see what happens. Oh, that didn't work. Stop, redo it, move things around. There's no penalty whatsoever. So you can experiment. So it's nice. It's very easygoing. You know, there's no rush. It's called Rush, but there's not actually any rush at all to playing the game. It's very laid back, and there's no pressure at all. And, you know, I don't think it's like the most brilliant, most exciting puzzle game I've ever played, but I think it works really well. And I mean, for the price, good Lord, it's certainly worth $2 if you like puzzle games. You know, it's a lot of spatial reasoning, and there's a little bit of physics involved, like, the little different colored cubes. Sometimes they come out, depending on the color, they might travel at different speeds. And so you might actually have the paths of two different colors of cubes crossing, but you might want to try to set it up so that they don't cross at exactly the same point at the same time, because otherwise they'll bump into each other. But because they're moving at different speeds, you can kind of create a loop or a situation in which they'll crisscross and they won't ever bang into each other. Mm-hmm. And there's other stuff like when a cube hits a wall, it changes direction. It turns to the right. And then it keeps traveling. And that's very useful for solving the puzzles, but it actually takes a second for it to bump into the wall, settle back down, and then start rolling in a different direction. And if you have other cubes coming up behind it on the same pathway, and you don't give them kind of enough space, or it depends on how fast the cubes come, but sometimes they'll start bumping into each other, just get backed up at the wall, and they won't have enough time to clear out. And so then you have to find a way to get around that. So you might have to redirect them before they get there, or maybe pick a different wall. So there's some kind of neat stuff with physics. I think in certain levels, it's not totally clear how the puzzle is set up. So I said, sometimes the cubes...
Isn't have like the title? Yeah. Oh, I played the WiiWare version actually. Actually, I'm looking at an old review that I wrote for Negative World.
Oh, nice.
It's kind of embarrassing now that I'm reading it. But I just
it's all in Franglish.
Yeah. No. It's just I don't know. People can read it, I guess. But there was 22 intermediate and 22 hard levels, and like mm-hmm. the easy ones were really too easy. But then. What I was going to say is that the intermediate and hard ones are the titles of those puzzles are always a clue, right, as to how to proceed.
Huh?
Have you no? How far are you in the game?
I played all the easy ones, and I think I tried like one intermediate level. So
okay, there's a significant jump in difficulty at intermediate, and then hard is just like oh my god, what's going on?
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me coming from the Tokitori guys, but, mm-hmm. I blasted through all the easy levels in one night, and I thought it was very engaging, and I thought I've already gotten my $2 worth out of it. So I'm sure I'll go back and mess around with it and play a little bit more. But, you know, if I hit a brick wall with this, I'm not going to be super pissed about it or anything. I thought it was a neat experience, and it's actually very refreshing to play a Wii U game that is played entirely through the touchscreen. That's just so unusual. And it works really well. So I would check it out. I'd say you know, it's pretty cool. Definitely. Awesome. If you're more into action games or platformers, even though it's still kind of puzzly and you do have to kind of think about things a little bit, I'd say get Edge. Cause Rush is really it's really strictly a puzzle game. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it looks cool. There's like nice electronic music, right, to it.
Yeah, I think Edge has better music, from what I heard. But, yeah, the presentation is slick, you know, it's very clean. It looks like a Wii game where they were trying to, you know, not use really busy backgrounds or anything. It's really, you know, just a very straightforward thing. You know, and the loss of the Rubik's Cube license really does nothing negative to this game. I mean, you look at it, you think, why was this a Rubik's Cube game in the first place? It doesn't even make sense, really, that this would be a Rubik's Cube game. So.
No.
Don't worry about it. But yeah, check it out. If you're looking for a cheap Wii U game, definitely I like it. And it's about as cheap as it gets, cheaper than an NES game. So why don't we move on now to Guillaume?
Sure. Waiting for Ace Attorney 5 to come out, I was listening, I think, to Connectivity, and I heard Neil, I believe, say that the Ace Attorney investigations or Apollo Justice were incredibly hard to find. And I was like, oh, really? So I remember looking it up on Amazon.ca and seeing that they had copies at maybe like $20 each. So I just grabbed Ace Attorney Investigations back then.
$20 Canadian?
Yeah. Anyway, so, but I did not start it until after I finished Ace Attorney 5 because, you know, why? Like, there's no, apparently it was kind of, James, was it kind of, what do they call that in comics? Retconned it.
Yeah, a bit.
Right.
I mean, they don't, there's nothing explicitly retconned. It's just sort of, you know, it's mostly related.
Right. Okay. So, I've started Ace Attorney Investigations, and at first I thought, whoa, I've made a huge mistake playing this so soon after Ace Attorney 5, because I forgot just, you know, the difference, the gap in terms of presentation values. I mean, it's not a bad-looking DS game, but compared to what we got on 3DS with the incredible animated 3D models...
Oh, yeah, it's night and day. Well, it's a whole different... Yeah, everything about the graphics engine is different.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
But this one was made for DS, at least. It's not like an up-ported GBA game.
It was barely made for DS.
Yeah, I'm not... Maybe it's because I'm playing it on a 3DS, but I don't find that there's a jump in visual quality between this and Apollo Justice. In fact, Apollo Justice might have been better looking.
Well, what Apollo Justice tries... Or what Investigations tries to do is a much more... wide angle than Apollo Justice, which is just a bunch of standing still images.
Right. Yeah.
So I would say on a technical, I mean, Apollo Justice is a DS game as well. I mean,
it is, but I just remember being more satisfied with it.
Barely.
But again, like it's all, you know, like my perspective is different after playing Ace Attorney 5. But yeah, so I played through the first case, and initially I was pretty disappointed because the first person that you face off against is this guy called Portsman, and he's kind of this generic sportsman character. It's really weird, like he's into tennis or something. He's constantly tugging at his sports jacket, and I didn't really find that he had any personality at all compared to basically any character from Ace Attorney 5, so I was a little bit down on my purchase. I thought, wow, okay, this might not be the jump in quality from Apollo Justice that I wanted and expected. But then, as soon as you hit the second case, Miles Edgeworth is himself being accused of a murder, so he has to defend his name in front of a flight attendant who's all like, oh no, I've found decisive evidence that you are the culprit, you know, like
she's evil as shit, yeah.
And she's decided that she's going to be a prosecutor, and you assure her that, no, you...
Yeah,
I know better than you what this job's about.
That the amazing part about that case is the majority of it takes place on an airplane.
Yeah, and the biggest goddamn airplane you've ever seen.
There's a luggage store in the airplane, which makes no sense on any level whatsoever.
Because you'd want to buy it after you got on the plane.
Yeah, yeah, you can buy luggage storage for the things you've already managed to get into your luggage.
So you just bring your clothes onto the plane.
Exactly. It's like, A, that would take up a lot of space. B, that shit would roll around. And C, why?
Yeah, no,
just
and
why?
They do comment on it, you know? Like, oh, yeah. It's like, part of the plot, actually.
It is.
That's and, so
yeah, so, you know, like, it was already kind of more interesting. But then, like, you face off against another flight attendant. And she just doesn't care at all what you're doing, you know. She's supposed to watch over you as you investigate the scene, and you'll be piecing evidence together, you know, like pressing the logic button. You have to actually make the connection between two pieces of evidence to form a conclusion. And while you're doing that, you know, Miles Edgeworth will explain, okay, so this piece of evidence is related to this, and that means blah, blah, blah. And she'll just be like, she'll have drool coming out of her mouth and like, what? You were saying something? You know?
Yeah.
And it's just already like way more character and way more personality than...
She's not easily impressed.
No, no. So it's pretty enjoyable so far. I don't know. Maybe I should have held off on Ace Attorney 5 before playing this because it's kind of a harsh step down in terms of presentation value.
I mean, it's a different game. That's part of what's amazing about this game is that they just said, you know, what we have is great. Mm-hmm. Let's do something totally different.
Right.
And they went and they made this kind of weird game where they hybridized the court case and the exploration. Mm-hmm. So there's really only one phase of the case, and it's all sort of compacted together. So you get these, like, servings of court stuff periodically throughout your investigation.
Right.
It makes the whole scene feel real different.
Oh, absolutely. And I do enjoy playing as Miles Edgeworth as the character. They've kind of phoenixed him a little bit by making him a little bit more bumbling than he's ever been in any of the other games. You know, at some point you actually, what are their names? The prosecutor with a whip, Franziska Von Karma.
Von Karma, yeah.
You know, she starts whipping at Gumshoe. And I think, you know, sometimes like she'll take a swipe at Edgeworth and actually Gumshoe gets hits, and I'm just like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, like Gumshoe is going to get all the hits and, you know, Miles has to keep his dignity, but no,
he's going to elegantly sidestep them.
Right. But no, he gets to taste the end of that whip, and, he gets to become more of a fool than you've ever seen him before in any other Ace Attorney games.
Part of the way they handle that is by giving him a counterpart that would make him so incredibly uncomfortable that it ends up sort of making him compromise on a lot of things. So a lot of the game is her going, no, I can take care of this, and then going to engage in some kind of real shady shit. And he's like, I don't think I like this. Can we not do this now? It creates a certain amount of making him seem much less in control of his own situation than he normally does.
I guess, you know, as a final word, the PSA, the games are not out of price and out of reach. They can be easily found, at least in Canada. So if anyone played Ace Attorney 5 first and wants to go back, it's pretty easy to do. As far as I could tell, pretty much all the games were back and, like, could be ordered, and, like, they're back in circulation somehow.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and play 1 through 3, skip 4.
Yep.
And then go ahead and play 5.
Yep.
You don't need to see 4.
No.
It's not worth it.
James hates Apollo.
I don't. I love Apollo in the 5th game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Understood.
In the 4th game, he's boring. He's dishwater.
Like, I absolutely agree that with James. Like, I would not recommend playing 4 because it turned me off the series. It's the whole reason why I waited until now to play Miles Edgeworth.
Mm-hmm. All right, James. So what have you been playing lately?
So what I've been playing lately, and lately being defined as the last month at this point, is I am still inching ever closer to the conclusion of Persona 3.
Oh. Or at least you think you are.
I know I'm inching to the end of it this time. Okay. Let's put it that way.
Okay. But have you been telling yourself that for the past 40 hours?
No, because I was pretty sure when they said, well, once we kill all these 12 bosses, everything will be great. I'm like, yeah, it's not going to be great. Like, they were way too up. I'm like, it's almost over! I'm like, no. You guys, no. That's not how RPGs work. And it wasn't. There's, like, 2 more months after that. So, like, a full 5th of the game. But it's been... What's really strange about this game, and it's something you really observe late. So I'm at about 82, 83 hours at this point, which is a big number.
Yeah.
Is that... The game becomes a lot more about preparing for the unknown than most JRPGs, because you can't go back and grind short of opening up an old save and sort of going back and doing a lot of the other unrelated stuff, because you have to sort of plan your grinding out ahead of time. So I'm getting ready for the absolute final end of the game boss right now, but I have no idea how strong to be. So there's a lot of me just dicking around going, all right, well, I guess I'll just go train some more. And I know what's going to happen, because I've seen it a lot of times in this game. I'll get to the boss and just job the hell out of them in about 30 seconds. Go, oh, all right. Well, that was weird.
So you haven't actually fought the boss yet?
I haven't. That's the thing, because the boss comes on a... Because this game works on a kind of real-time calendar, mm-hmm. Yeah. i.e. there's 31 days in the months that have 31 days, and you need to be ready for that. Mm-hmm. And they say, like, on the 19th, you're going to fight the boss. Well, you could do whatever you want for the 31 days between boss fights, But if you're not getting ready, you're going to get your shit wrecked.
Yeah.
I hope the final boss is like a demonic protractor.
That would be amazing at this point. Like, I would just be like, yes, thank you, game.
Did you ace your finals?
I did. I aced my last three sets of finals, my last three sets of exams. I have maxed out all the main character stats, meaning that he is, I'm trying to remember how the game words it. Shoot, what's it? Oh yeah, he is a genius, charismatic badass. Game's words.
You're just too cool for school.
I'm literally too cool for school. That is a literal thing. I am literally too cool for school in this game. It's amazing. This game is, it's weird how it grows on you as time goes on. So what you find yourself doing early in the game, you end up kicking yourself for late in the game. Like, I could have made much better use of my time back in June. And you realize, wow, this game's fucking with your head so bad that you're pissed off about something you did half a month ago or in game time about 6 months ago. Thanks, game. Totally unproductive use of time? Yes. I figure, I know there is a special dungeon area that I need to unlock. I know I've got about 22 days of training left for the boss. So, I figure I've probably got another 10-ish hours in this game, which will put me at around the 94 mark, which is nuts. I haven't played 94-hour long games in a long time.
Since what, Xenoblade?
Yeah, probably. Which is a while ago. And before that, I don't remember what it would have been.
A couple years ago for you.
Yeah, and like I said, before that, I don't know. I mean, they just don't make JRPGs that long anymore. Not usually. Yeah, The Last Remnant. That would be it.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Jesus, that game was long.
Yeah.
That game makes this game look short.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that, The Last Remnant, for like six episodes of our.
Well, the beauty of that, that's the one where the Xbox died in the middle of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right before the last boss, the Xbox died.
And you got shoes. That's the Xbox that turned into shoes.
Yeah, I got shoes. Yeah. If you haven't read that story, there's a long-running narrative on the NWR site about me and my trials and tribulations with Xbox repair service.
That's in the Hall of Fame, man. Yeah, that's good. Way out there.
I really like this game. I like that as I learned to play it, how I experienced the game evolved. Really, it's the only way that I could sustain a game of this length, where effectively you're going to school, making friends, and then staying up all night punching monsters in the head. I mean, it's really just out there, and there's so many things to learn that I've kind of enjoyed doing it. I was planning on playing 4 pretty soon after 3, but I didn't think it was going to take me this long, so maybe I'll wait a little while.
Yeah, you might want to take a break.
Play something, anything else.
Play
at this point.
6 other games over the next month, and then maybe you'll be ready.
I'll be ready. Well, unfortunately, one of those games is going to be, I won't say unfortunate, it's going to be great. One of them is going to be Bravely Default, so
yeah.
I might need a JRPG break.
Apparently that game's pretty damn long, too.
That game is long. Yeah. It's really and the second version for the sequel is longer, apparently.
If Dragon Quest VII ever comes out this year.
Actually, whew. I read that the improved version of Bravely Default was supposed to be shorter.
I think it moves faster. I think there's more stuff.
Okay.
I think you could spend time doing other garbage.
Because I think that Squaresoft actually announced that you could finish the game in about 30 hours or something.
Whoa,
and previously, the previous version was supposed to be, at least 60, 70, I don't know.
Yeah, 30 hours would be a fairly short JRPG.
Yeah,
I would love
like
that.
It.
What?
I tend to like them that length too, but yeah. If I'm really enjoying it, I'm cool through about 50. And after about 50 hours, I don't care how much I like that game, I'm probably ready for it to be. That's how I felt about Xenoblade. It's like the first 50 hours, awesome. I love this. And then like the last 30, oh, guys, just
but see,
make
to
it
me,
stop.
To me, what was great about it was they just kept showing me more stuff. And eventually you're like, I've given up on the game ever trying to go onto a detente. Like, Xenoblade felt the need to just keep topping itself.
Yeah.
To the point where you end up with that ending. And you're just like, ah! Ah! And like, I spent like a month and a half waiting for you assholes to play the game so I could yell at somebody about the ending. If you don't plan to play it, just go read how that game ends. Cause it's crazy bananas.
It'd be pretty wonderful, I'm not saying this would happen even necessarily on Wii U, but maybe in 5 or 10 years, if they ever did like an HD remake of Xenoblade, I think it would be a wonderful candidate. And they could tighten up some things too, but I think that game already looks amazing on Wii, and I think, you know, if they really took the time like they did with Wind Waker and with some other games to really make it shine graphically, I think that game would hold up extremely well even several years from now. So,
oh, yeah.
I wouldn't give up and forever, but, you know.
Introduce a whole new set of people to the what the fuck ending.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's wonderful.
All right. Well, why don't we go around the horn for a couple extra games here. And I'll talk just briefly about the demo. I did not buy the full version for Chibi Robo Photo Finder. And, you know, I really, really like Chibi Robo on GameCube. I think it's a kind of a wonderful sleeper hit kind of a game. You know, if you've ever played Chibi Robo, you probably love it. The problem is you've probably never played Chibi Robo. I mean, just
probably not.
Not many people ever gave it a chance, and it came out really late on GameCube. It was bad timing. I think it was a 2005 release for GameCube. It's a really wonderful game. It has a very odd, very charming story, just wonderful animations. And it's really a 3D exploration game. It's a kind of a 3D platformer without that much jumping. It's just more about exploring this house and figuring out how you're going to move around it and get up to higher areas. And then as you go, you learn some really strange things about the family that lives in that house. So I guess part of the reason I'm not super gaga, crazy, excited over this 3DS game, is it's not that it's a download game or anything. I never got the sense that it was going to have that kind of scope. You know, I never got the sense that it would be this really big environment that I could explore and that it would, you know, be trying to tell this story about these people and that it would really try to capture the scale. I mean, Chibi Robo is all about scale. He's a tiny robot in a big house. So, you know, if you're not going to capture that kind of, you know, that sense of place and of size and of locomotion as you explore this big environment, to me, you've lost a lot of what makes the series awesome. I never did play the DS one. I'm hoping that becomes a download option at some point down the road because I'd love to try that. But, you know, the Photo Finder, you know, based on the demo alone, I would say it does seem to be broken up into smaller chunks and smaller environments, which is kind of too bad. But, and that's kind of what I feared. And it does have, you know, it has a lot of this AR stuff where it's asking you to go and take photos of things. And I think the way it does it is kind of neat, but that really doesn't appeal to me that much. I was much more interested in getting in there, controlling Chibi Robo, running around, doing the things that you do as Chibi Robo. You clean up, you look for things, you find little knickknacks, you take them to people, you make people happy, you get happy points, and you watch Chibi Robo be cute as hell. And you do get to do a lot of that stuff in the demo. So that is promising. And I actually like the demo more than I expected to. I kind of downloaded it kind of dreading what they had done to my beautiful Chibi Robo franchise. And I think it actually retains more of the original appeal than I expected to, given the format and everything going on here with the 3DS game. And I think one thing that I wasn't expecting at all is that the graphics are pretty amazing in this game.
Well, if you think about it, 3DS is way more powerful than a GameCube is.
It is, yeah, but you don't really see that very much. You know, you don't really see a whole lot of games take advantage of that. And I certainly wouldn't expect a, you know, $10 or $15 download title to like really show up a GameCube, pretty advanced GameCube game. But the environments in this Chibi Robo are just stunning. Now they do have a depth of field effect that makes things farther away look blurry. And when I first looked at it, I looked at the background. I thought that looks kind of pre-rendered, you know, like they put it back there just to kind of give a sense of depth to this place. But that stuff's not really being created in 3D. But actually, if you kind of test the boundaries of the environment, you can get close enough to some of that stuff that's in the background for it to clear up. And you'll see that it is made of polygons and they're like very detailed textures. So, there's some stuff in this game that I think like visually is probably some of the most impressive stuff I've ever seen on 3DS. And I think it shows there's a lot more power in this handheld than we're used to seeing. Or maybe it's just that this game is it's trying to create realistic looking environments. And there's just almost no 3DS game that even attempts that. You know, so maybe it's not that it's using more horsepower. Maybe it's just that the graphic style is different than we're used to. But I think it's really impressive. And I think, you know, Chibi Robo is so cute. I mean, the animations are great. The character design is just really wonderful. I love the little plug that trails him around like a tail. And you can pick it up and run around with it and stick it into a wall. That stuff is just, it's not any different than before, but it's just, it's so wonderful to see that. I guess my problem with the game, other than the AR stuff, which just, again, I think it's handled fairly well, but, it just doesn't appeal to me that much. It's not the reason that I would ever buy this. It just feels like the controls are really stiff, and it's been a long time since I played the GameCube game, and maybe they were the same way, and maybe I just got used to it over the 20 hours it took to beat that game. But playing the 3DS demo, I just feel like, man, Chibi Robo just, he doesn't turn very quickly. He barely jumps. Like, there's a jump button, but he doesn't really jump much of anything. Hmm. And it just doesn't feel great running around with him. But I'm so, like, distracted by the environments and by the everything going on that maybe it's okay. You know, I mean, I don't think the game is really about Twitch jumping or, you know, turning on a dime or anything, but it just feels weird. It doesn't feel very Nintendo-like the way that he controls. And, you know, so it's like there's some good and some bad here. And as far as the demo goes, I'm really kind of on the edge as to whether I want to spend the money to download the rest of it. And I think I'm going to have to go out and seek out reviews, but at least there is a demo. I'm really glad Nintendo's doing this, especially with a brand new game. If you haven't tried it yet, you know, go get the free demo, try it. I mean, especially if you've never played Chibi Robo, it is a franchise worth, you know, becoming, exposed to. It's worth trying, worth learning more about. And, the character is just, he's not quite like any other character that Nintendo has. And I think just getting to see him up close and see some of the things that he does and getting to play with him just a little bit is very worthwhile. I'm curious enough that I do want to do a little more research about it. I wouldn't call the demo convincing, but it's intriguing for sure. I'm surprised you guys haven't tried it.
I just haven't had the chance.
I haven't had a whole lot of time either, but
I'm kind of waiting until there's more daylight, because from everything I've read, it sounds like you get really yellowish pictures unless you've got optimal lighting.
Yeah, I mean, my experience with the 3DS camera obscura game, oof.
Fatal Frame, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, not Fatal Frame, whatever they called it.
Whatever.
Yeah. Doesn't make me feel great about a game based around trying to do AR stuff, because that sucks.
Yeah, it does require a lot of light, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think this game, though, it has a lot of leeway and you know, it seems to be very forgiving. For instance, the first silhouette film that they gave me was supposed to be a power outlet, although it wasn't really clear to me until after I took the photo that that's what they were expecting me to take a photo of. But it was a rectangle with some, you know, kind of like vertical lines, inside of it. And it was meant to be of a power outlet that you'd find on a wall. Well, to me, it was just like just a rectangle, and I wasn't anywhere near a power outlet. So I was like, well, I've got my phone here. I was listening to a podcast at the time. So I was like, I'll just take a picture of my phone. It's the right shape, at least on the outline. And so I took a picture of the back of my iPhone, and it worked. I mean, it gave me like a 60-something% rating. So it was like not the greatest photo ever, but it was good enough. It passed. And they slapped it on a kind of a little polygon thing, and then you're carrying it around, and you go and you put it in the museum. And in the museum, it's funny because you can spin it around. It's a 3D model. And on the backside, it looks like the back of a power outlet. So you can like see the little electrodes and conduits and the green plastic and, you know, all the connection stuff that's on the other side of a power outlet. But then the front of it is just like the back of my iPhone. So it's really goofy. And like, I like that it gives you the flexibility to do stuff like that. I also think it can be, you could probably do some really funny stuff with it by like taking photos of things that it's not really expecting. So, you know, I mean, it's, you can work around problems with your environment or problems with your camera, but, yeah, it's a neat little thing. It's definitely worth checking out the demo.
Awesome.
And with our remaining time here on New Business, why don't we hear about one more game from Mr. Viet?
Sure. Sure. I downloaded one of the new Club Nintendo rewards this month, Spin 6, which is a Nintendo-published DSiWare puzzle game. And I understand why most people probably avoided DSiWare on the DSi, because the DSi shop was designed so that you would never visit it a second time.
This is true.
No, it was designed so you would never survive the first visit.
Yeah, yeah. It was out to kill you with bad design.
But that actually gives it more credit than it deserves.
Yeah, it was accidental. But it would be, I think, a mistake to ignore DSiWare puzzle games published by Nintendo, because they were on the 3DS, because the store is much better, and they were almost all really interesting or good. And this time you get it for free, or 150 Club Nintendo coins. So definitely jump on the chance to get this. So it's, you know, like it's a matching the gems puzzle game, except that, in this case, the gems are basically like numbers from 3 to 6. And, when you match 3 gems in a line, in a row, that have the number 3, they turn into 3 gems of the number 4. If you can chain that with another number 4, they turn into 5. And eventually, when you chain 6 gems with a 6 on them, they disappear. And it's the only way to make them disappear. So you can really set up interesting combos with that. And, you know, it kind of looks on the surface like a Bejeweled clone, but it's really not. It plays differently. You spin these, you know, like groups of 4 of these jewels, hence the name, Spin 6. And it's just, I'm not, you know, super proficient at the game yet, but it's pretty interesting and it's pretty fun so far. And there are several modes. So for you know, a game that you get for free, I think it's pretty complete. I've seen other DSiWare puzzle games that have maybe like one mode and they feel really unfinished. They don't feel very satisfying. But here you've got, you know, like the puzzle mode with 100 puzzles that you're supposed to solve by doing one move. And it sounds easier than it is, because when you can absolutely spin any combination of these gems, like sometimes it's really like you're really scratching your head for a while trying to figure out exactly what move you're supposed to make. But I think that what really pushes this game over the top is the presentation, which is completely absurd. I haven't seen everything it has, but like every mode has its own characters and its own goofy, weird crap that makes absolutely no sense. For instance, every time that you solve a puzzle in the puzzle mode, you get a piece of trivia. So this trivia can be, you know, like just kind of weird, like cows can produce 70 to 80 quarts of saliva every day. But sometimes they get really, yeah.
Just amateurs. Amateurs.
But the one of the pieces of trivia is that sometimes it can lie. So, you know, like maybe don't take everything that this little blue alien creature tells you. You know, take it with a grain of salt. But sometimes also like the trivia
like a
that it gives
your ass
you.
Move.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really trust our research department.
Sometimes the trivia that it gives you is also strangely off-putting. Like, lefties have slightly higher mortality rates than righties. I'm ambidextrous, you know? And there's another one that really, like, made me uneasy a little bit. Do your initials spell a word? You might outlive those whose initials don't. So, you know, like, that's always good to
know.
Oh, you know
what? If your initials don't spell a word, you might outlive those that do.
This sounds like the kind of crap you hear on, like, John Tesh radio show. It's like,
why does John Tesh have a radio show?
John Tesh radio show? Shame on you.
That's a great question. I've heard it before, unfortunately, as a captive in other people's cars, and their tagline is like, intelligence.
Is that a thing?
Their tagline is like, intelligence to make your life better. It's like, there's not an ounce or shred of intelligence on that show. It's just all like random statistical trivia bullshit.
I can tell this John Tesh rant has been boiling inside of Johnny for quite a while.
I'm just saying DSiWare is the John Tesh of video games.
I don't know. Like, this random trivia can be, I don't know. I think it can be useful. For instance, Johnny, you're perfectly normal. The average human burps from 10 to 12 times a day. So, you know, maybe you don't have the problem you thought you had. But it's not, you know, so that's just one of the modes. And in another mode, the score attack mode, Once your, you know, like once your time limit is over, and it evaluates your performance, it does so by measuring a pig, and the pig gets taller as your score gets higher. And, it's for no apparent reason. And, you know, when I say it gets taller,
you're fattening
just
out
like
for the slaughter.
It's just, no, it's not being fattened. Actually, it stretches, you know, like its girth doesn't change. It's just like, it just becomes a really, really freakish pig.
Hmm.
So lots of personality, let's say, in this game.
let's
call it that, shall we? So it's, I don't know. It's very cool. And I'm not complaining for a free
All right,
game.
So that's called,
it's pretty damn cool.
That's called Spin 6. And is it still available as a Club Nintendo reward?
Oh yeah. Like this is new. This is a new reward. So it's good for the next month.
That sounds completely bizarre. I'm piqued. My interest is piqued.
Awesome.
All right, guys. Well, why don't we take a quick break? We'll come back in a minute with listener mail, including our stupid, dumb predictions for 2014.
Genius prediction time! 2014!
Oh, yeah.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First this week, we have a video, Alan and Nicole, a Miiverse romantic tragedy in one act by Curtis Bonds. Curtis made a video about the Miiverse. It's unbelievable. So go watch it, because you really won't believe me if I try to describe it here.
There's even a sequel already, so
there
check
is.
That out
yeah.
as well.
It's madness.
Yeah, this video got picked up by Kotaku and a whole bunch of different websites.
Hey, that's not Curtis's fault.
No, it's gone viral. I mean, it's a big deal. And We had it first, so congrats to Curtis. I still need to catch up with it myself. I might do that tonight. Next up, we have a feature called Nintendo Collector's Journal by Justin Berube. This is a kind of a weekly or bi-weekly thing that Justin does. Justin says he owns the, quote, complete collection of 3DS XL charging cradles. I'll leave it at that. You can watch his collection, move him one step closer to an episode of Hoarders right here on our NWR Exclusives YouTube channel.
We have our regular feature of Danny Bivens bragging about what the Japanese eShop is getting.
Hey, we haven't done this in a long time.
yep, well, here's Bivens again, bragging about the eShop.
More like Danny Braggins.
We haven't talked about downloads in Japan since they stopped the weekly Nintendo video segments about bikini girls butt bouncing. I think I missed that.
You did.
Tell me it's on YouTube.
I'm sure it is.
But this week, Japan got Shining Force Gaiden for Game Gear. 3DS batteries a whirl over are now flat.
But we have a video. Alex discusses the potential of Yoshi's New Island by Alex Calafi. Ever want to watch Alex talks about yet another Nintendo 2D platformer in low light in front of a professional microphone? It's like if you could watch his podcast, except he's clothed. It's funny because it's true.
Alright,
and we also have a feature, Nintendo World Report's 2014 predictions by staff. We are actually holding staves.
Yeah.
Oh lord,
yes!
Here we go.
Yes.
Our staff of experts makes a clearly ill-advised decision to predict what will happen in the world of Nintendo this year. Good thing nobody on this show would make such a rash and poorly thought out decision. Additionally, stay tuned for our predictions right after the jump.
Alright, so if you just can't get enough predictions or you're interested in any of the weird stuff we just talked about, please head over to NintendoWorldReport.com.
Shit's getting real weird on this website.
Welcome back. It is time for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. All right, so the first email this week comes from Leo, and John is going to read that one.
Leo writes, Johnny, sorry, but while going over predictions from 2012, you said that Pandora's Tower was a lost cause and everybody needed to inform.
That happened like the next day.
I guess Greg made a prediction that in 2012, Goodfeel would make a Yoshi game in the style of Kirby's Epic Yarn on Wii. Wow, not bad, just 2 years too early because it's coming for Wii U, we think. I mean, it's coming to Wii U. We haven't heard anything about it since that one trailer in the January 2013 Nintendo Direct. James predicted we'd hear all about the Japanese exchange rate.
Mostly from James.
If only you hadn't said this isn't part of my prediction when you brought up Mario Curling, because Mario and Sonic has curling and it uses the gamepad, just like you mentioned. Will you be doing more again this year?
Unfortunately, yes. We will do more predictions.
To be fair, yeah, fuck it. Fuck it. I give up. This segment, no matter how good we do, and we've had good years. I had a pretty good year last year, but no matter what we do, we always get just dragged through the mud for the stupid shit.
Yeah, yeah. People always make fun of us.
The incident with Pandora's Tower was amazing, if only because it pretty much happened the day after we recorded.
Sad trombone.
Hey, again, I'll say it again. I was happy to be wrong about that.
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh, it was just an amazing level of just like, wow, really?
It's also probably one of the most unlikely things you could ever see happening. Like, I can't believe Nintendo's letting this company do Pandora's Tower.
Yeah.
A rated M Wii game in 2013.
It's fucking unbelievable.
What a crazy thing to do, and luckily it worked out really well. So
yeah, I'm pleased people got to play that game, and we talked about it on the show.
And actually, one of the best predictions we've ever had on the show wasn't like at the beginning of the year. It was on a PAX East panel, and I was involved. I don't know that I was the only one. I think I had some help on this one. We might have tag teamed a little bit, but it was back there in the. I think it was even before the Project Cafe rumors, before Wii U was revealed back in 2011, and I said they would release some kind of. New system with a controller that would have a touchpad on the controller, which no one had ever done before for a gaming console. And I didn't predict that it would be a screen. I thought it might just be just a pad without the screen, which eventually Sony did with the DualShock 4. That was pretty close, I thought. So, we've had good ones and bad ones. We have some real bad ones. But all right, let's get to new predictions for 2014. Against my better judgment, who wants to go first? I said one, two, three.
I'll go first.
We're only going to do maybe a couple each. So.
Oh, God.
I'm just going to go out there. I'm going to go full doom and gloom, and I'm going to say that Iwata will resign this year.
Wow.
Wow.
Will he commit seppuku?
That was going to be my question.
that was going to be Guillaume's prediction.
Yeah, I'm kidding. I wouldn't wish that on any man, but due to the Wii U performance,
Wow. All right. So that was our prediction segment. Check back next year for when we shame John for saying a man is going to kill himself.
I didn't say that. I'm just saying, when in Rome.
When in Rome, kill yourself, is what you're saying. Thank you, John. This segment has gone very badly wrong.
No, I think the first part.
I blame everyone but myself.
Hey, we led him, like we led him to the river, but I think Iwata resigning is not out of the question. I hope not. I hope not. I like that guy, but
unfortunately, I don't think it's complete hyperbole.
Yeah, we'll see. I certainly wouldn't put money on it, but it wouldn't be the most shocking thing ever either.
That would be a really, really That'd be a really just awful thing to put money on.
Well, I just don't think that people have talked about it too much because they really don't know who might replace him. Well, because really, things have been really bad for a while.
And he's made
a lot of promises that he has been wildly wide of the mark on.
Yeah. Well,
just like this segment.
For sure. That's not a reason for someone to lose their job necessarily. I think him being off on forecasts and stuff is not nearly as egregious as just the system ain't selling, but apparently it just had its best month ever. And, that's a relative term, but, they will certainly ride that and they will hope that they can sort of build some momentum on it. And the thing about, game console sales is that, they do kind of snowball. Like once you hit a critical mass, you can at least keep selling games to those people and you get closer and closer to profitability. So, just because things have been bad in the past doesn't mean they can't get better. So I think this is a make or break year, though, especially the early half of this year. Be really interesting to see what they do. Let's move on to something a little more positive. I'll throw one out. You guys are going to laugh at me because this something similar always seems to come up. This is completely unrelated to Retro Studios per se. But I think by the end of this year, Nintendo will announce some kind of Metroid game, but it probably won't be what we want. But there will be there will be a game with Metroid in the title announced by the end of this year.
Even if it's like Metroid Pinball 2?
Yeah. I mean, it could be, at this point, I'll take it. I'll take it.
Yeah, I'll take it.
But, I mean, I'm hoping it's something a little more substantive than that. And
Metroid Paint.
And honestly, it wouldn't surprise me at all if it was a 3DS game. And I don't really think it's going to be anything from Retro Studios. I think they're going to need, even though supposedly they have two teams, you know, so maybe they've broken off a splinter to do something along those lines, even as they finish up Donkey Kong. But, I think it could very well be from a different studio. But, I think Nintendo knows that they're losing a certain segment of their fan base. And it's not as simple as breaking that down and just saying it's the Metroid fans. You know, it's a lot more complicated than that. But I think I think they will realize that they could garner a certain amount of goodwill among a certain group of fans who are not that happy right now. And it might do them a lot of good to announce a game in this franchise, which has not had a game since 2009, I believe, was Other M. So it's been quite a while. And again, it may not really be like a core Metroid title. It might be something kind of, you know, Samus kart racing or I don't know, but it'll be some kind of Metroid title. That's my prediction. Who's next up to the guillotine?
I can go. Sure. This is kind of wishful thinking, as most of my predictions are, but, I think that we're going to see a new game by Skip. Actually, and yes, I'm a little bit inspired by the fact that we talked about Chibi Robo earlier. But
yeah, I don't think they made this Photo Finder 3DS game.
No, they have, but this was released a while ago in Japan, so they must have been working on something since. And this is really like their only 3DS game so far, and they haven't released anything on the Wii U yet. And I know that they're a smaller developer, you know, they haven't released anything like any. Kind of any art style type game or anything like that. So I think that maybe they're working on something a little bit more substantial, a la Captain Rainbow or Chibi Robo.
Is that really substantial? Chibi Robo is pretty substantial, actually.
Kind of a retail.
Substantially alarming.
Sure.
kind no, of a I get retail what you mean. Project, yeah. You know? So, that's cool. You know, like, whether it's Gift Pia 2 or whatever it is, like, it might not be sold at retail. Like, it might be an eShop game, but
it might not sell at retail too.
Right. But, you know, like, I think that they're going to have, something more than just a puzzle game.
Cool.
So I'm going to go back to a prediction I made probably last year, probably the year before that, because eventually Nintendo's going to have to get this shit right. I say, knowing full well they may never get this shit right.
Yeah, it's true.
We have really reached the point on 3DS where its install base is relatively gargantuan. We were talking about it between segments, and it's sold, you know, like 40 million units worldwide. I mean, there's a shit ton of 3DSs out there.
It was the best-selling hardware in America in the year of 2013.
And not by a small margin.
No, and just to be clear, it's not as successful as DS so far. Growing more slowly than DS did, but it's still doing really well, especially in the more competitive, you know, less booming video game industry of today.
Exactly.
It's doing comparatively very, very, very well.
But that sort of goes to where I wanted to go with this prediction, because the 3DS was a huge, huge success, or has been a huge success. Not a huge, huge success. DS, however, was a gargantuan success. And that meant there were a ton of games released on DS that ultimately meant that many of them simply did not get the level of attention that they probably deserved.
Sure.
Which means it really absolutely is fucking time for Nintendo to figure out how to put DS games on the eShop.
Ugh.
I think now that they've got 3DS games, 3DS retail games on the eShop, and the DS can play, a 3DS can play DS retail games natively, it really just seems like a matter of time before they find the right way to trick their own firmware into treating these downloaded DS games like retail games, at which point they just sort of run. They seem to have figured out most of the parts there. It seems like one last jump to get them there, and they could just drop the ROM right on the eShop and be done with it.
Yeah, I mean, so if they can make Wii games show up on the gamepad screen, then they should be able to do this. This should be easier than that, I would think.
So not only do I think that's going to happen, I think when it does happen, you're going to see a much more open floodgates than we've seen for other stuff, because who the fuck wants to play Game Gear games? Nobody.
Well, also, I mean, it
kind of do.
I don't think it would be.
I've played Game Gear games. No, you don't.
No, just to I agree with you, James. I think it would be more of a opening the floodgates thing, because if they make it work, it really shouldn't be an emulator kind of situation.
No, it's just running like a DS cart. At which point,
so you wouldn't have to go through like really extensive testing on every single game that you want to release. It should just be like, well, let's throw our whole catalog on there. So it'll be up to the publisher, but
I think publishers right now are. I mean, there's a lot of publishers out there who are hurting for money at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. And I think this would be a real easy way for them to get a little bit of Skrilla back in their pocket real quick. There's 40 million 3DSs out there. I think what you'd see is you'd see a lot of publishers going, I want in. Just put my DS games out there. Well, they probably made a ton of them.
Not least of which Nintendo. I mean, how many friggin' downloads of Picross 3D could they sell?
Oh, God.
The first month, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all groaning because we know we will buy it and play it and destroy our lives all over again.
I think what Picross 3D probably won't come out because Nintendo probably wants to make Picross 60 or be 90. I don't know.
I was hoping they'd call it 3D.
Oh, that's too much. That's too much. But I could see companies who are, you know, limping along financially saying, all right, we're going to put all of our DS games out there over the course of the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, we're going to price them relatively aggressively because, A, it's not real hard for us to get them ready for this, quote, virtual console. And, B, we want to sell. There's 40 million 3DSs out there. We need to price competitively.
Well, also, I was going to say, what you would hope is that so many publishers get involved and release so many games that there's actual competition and that drives the prices down.
Because there are a lot, and I mean, stultifying number of DS retail games.
Yeah. I mean, I owned, I think, about 30, and my collection was not that impressive compared to
50, and that's not even, like, a fifth of the collection.
And I would totally rebuy at least half the games that I own for DS, just to have them on the system all the time.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Especially if they do what, I don't know if it ever came out or not, they said they were releasing something that lets you move game saves from 3DS carts to the eShop version.
Yeah, they've done that.
Mm-hmm. If they could do that with the DS carts as well, shit.
But DS game saves aren't saved to SD card. They're saved on the game cartridge.
They'd have to figure that out anyway.
Well, and there may be a handful of games that just have certain features that are unsupported, or maybe there's just certain games that, you know, that stuff is too integral and you just can't really make it work. But 90% of the games released on DS don't have any online crap at all. So.
Yeah, and they're perfectly serviceable games you could release and just be done with it.
Oh, tons. I mean, the sales alone of New Super Mario Brothers. I mean, that game sold, I think, over 30 million copies on Nintendo DS.
The dumbest. That game was in the top 10 for like 4 years.
And I mean, even now on the eShop, every single Mario game is right up there in the top sellers still. I mean,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, people just buy them over and over again just to have them on every single system.
Well, great prediction, James. It would be the best thing ever, and it probably
happen. See, I have one more caveat there. Here's my prediction of companies that would do it, and it should be pretty easy to figure out who they are.
Atlas?
Yeah. Well, yeah. but that's Sega.
Yeah.
That's Sega doing it on Atlas's behalf, because Sega needs that cash, yo.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Sega, Sega, Square Enix, and Capcom.
Square Enix will get around to it like 4 years later.
Square Enix needs that cash now.
Yeah, they do.
Well, that's not true. Bravely Default made them rich again. I don't know. They needed that cash. They're putting on, like, elaborate stage shows of Bravely Default music. Because fuck everything, Square Enix. What are you up to?
Now that you've got us all salivating, James, why don't we move on to John. Do you have any other predictions, John?
Yeah, I do. Speaking of Square Enix, you know, the release of Earthbound was unexpected, but it has emboldened me to make the following prediction.
Oh, God.
That Terranigma will be released on Wii U.
Oh, get the fuck out.
That'd be awesome, but
now there's something I want that I can't have. Thanks.
Terranigma?
It's already in English. I mean, there's a European version that's extremely valuable.
Have you seen the English? Mm. It's not great.
You know, it's British.
Would this be released in 50 hertz?
Yeah.
Probably,
It's going to make your eyes bleed.
Nintendo can just do whatever they want to make this happen, but it's going to happen. You can just lock this one in. Lock it in. Put money on it.
Bless your little heart.
I'm going to say that Nintendo itself published Illusion of Gaia from the same developer, and they haven't even released that on the Wii Virtual Console. So
I'm not going
to
say anything.
Well, they probably don't have the rights to it anymore.
Come on.
Yeah. Right, right. So I think that makes Terranigma even less likely.
Yeah, that company doesn't really Quintet doesn't exist anymore, but their IP was absorbed by Square Enix during the merger, so Square Enix owns Illusion of Gaia and Terranigma and Soul Blazer.
They bought
and
Quintet,
all that stuff.
Dissolved all the amazing dev teams that worked there to make them make fucking terrible Final Fantasy spinoffs, and then said, ha 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 ha, evilly.
Yes. Okay, well, how about the next prediction?
Fuck you.
Who wants to throw one out?
I admit that I've been busy with other stuff, so sorry for this throwaway prediction that's clearly not very serious, but you know how Mario Golf has been pushed back?
Yeah.
For the 3DS? And you know how
I had forgotten it exists.
Yeah, there's like no mention of it anymore. I think there's a good reason. I think there's also a good reason why Iwata has said recently that the Year of Luigi would continue. It's because they're completely retooling Mario Golf to transform it into Luigi Golf, a completely new game. Yeah, and obviously a retooling of this magnitude takes time.
Dear God. They're just going to paint all the surfaces green.
Yep.
Done. So,
it's Goth. Everything's already green, James.
So that's the reason why we haven't seen it yet.
I've actually heard that the delay might be to add in an RPG mode after all the complaints of the tennis game.
Oh, I think that's a lot of wishful thinking.
I think that actually might have some credence to it.
I mean, I would think, to me, the RPG mode's the only thing that made the GBA game worth playing. So
yeah.
I heard it was then there, I'm like, I'm out.
Well, if you recall that with Mario Tennis last year on 3DS, the argument was you won't even miss the RPG mode because you'll be playing online so much. And I think they probably looked at the usage, you know, that looked at the online traffic for that game and said, oh, actually, as it turns out, not only did this game not sell all that great, but also the people who bought it didn't even really play it online very much.
Well, I mean, when you bought Mario 3-on-3 Hoops, you were going to play that online too.
Yeah. Jeez. Oh, that did have online, didn't it?
It did. Yeah.
That's so weird. That whole game is so weird. Speaking of one, I would totally pay $5 to download.
Oh my god.
That bit of weirdness.
But you're not gonna be able to cover the psychological trauma you get from playing that game. Oh.
Well, I've got one left, and it's kind of a biggie, but maybe we'll go last. James, do you have any other predictions?
I think Nintendo continues to milk images of games like X pretty much all year, but ultimately doesn't pay off and give us anything to play it this year.
Okay. That's
sad. Likely.
Yeah. It's sad. But it's like I see us getting like 5 Nintendo Directs featuring that game, and ultimately like Iwata's like, not yet, gotcha.
And we're not gonna see Yoshi's Epic Yarn in any of them.
Yeah, sure we will. Yoshi will come out this year, and I would be surprised, actually, if X doesn't come out at least in Japan by the end of the year, because you got to remember, Xenoblade came out in Japan a long time ago. So they've been working on X for quite a while.
Oh, yeah, I could see it coming out in Japan, but I think we're going to get, like, 4 Nintendo Directs with X video. Yeah. And not
all
yet.
Right, so I'll finish up this little mini feature before we move on to the next email. And my other prediction is a little bit of a two-parter. I think at E3 we will learn something about Miyamoto's big new IP that he's been working on, and I'm not going to predict what that is because I think it will be the kind of thing that no one could ever predict. It'll just be something so different. I mean, probably have like some kind of new character that he's created, but the game itself will be something that, you know, it's just pretty much impossible to predict. But I think as part of announcing that, he will say that will be his last game for Nintendo. But it won't actually be. In other words,
Miyazaki, yes, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think he will basically declare his retirement along with revealing this big kind of magnum opus. But then in the end, he won't really be able to retire, and he will end up making, or at least he'll end up being some kind of supervisor. You know, he'll continue on in some capacity even after that. But he'll basically come out and say, I really wanted to get in and make like one last big game before I got too old to do this kind of thing. And that'll be kind of how the game is sold. It'll be like this swan song. It'll be part of the marketing and part of the story of how that game is revealed.
He will shock everyone at E3 by saying, this is my last Nintendo game. I'm moving over to Sega at last.
And Sega go, oh shit, we can't afford that.
No, that's...
You're making a pachinko game.
That's absurd.
Yes, we need more pachinko.
Oh dear.
Jesus.
All right.
Sega Sammy can go die in a ditch. There you go.
Oh boy.
Jeez.
Wow.
Harsh.
Okay, I'm going to read the next email, just move away from this
please
train
get us
wreck
out
of
here.
The predictions thing. Torbjorn writes, when looking back on my assessment of older games, the use of hub worlds or overworlds seems to be important for how I feel about them. To give some examples, the rich overworld of Diddy Kong Racing is one of the main reasons why I preferred this game over Mario Kart 64 back in the day. The overworld of Super Mario Galaxy, although limited, still felt a whole lot more interesting than the level selection in Galaxy 2. Banjo-Kazooie's overworld made the whole game feel really cohesive and interesting to explore, and of course the castle in Mario 64 has to be mentioned. So the question is, how do you guys feel about the use of overworlds? Do you agree with my view on older games like DKR and Banjo-Kazooie? And what do you think this type of hub world could have done for 3D World?
Jay John, what do you think it could have done for 3D World, the game neither of us have played?
I don't know.
I feel
like there was a certain point where hub worlds became overused. They were just in everything.
There is some of that, yeah. I think it was a long time ago, but there was a time. Yeah.
There are games, and it probably starts with Mario 64, where the hub world basically was just another level that you could get to levels with.
Mm-hmm. But it had its own secrets and shortcuts.
Yeah, it was,
and...
but it was basically a level. And I think Banjo-Kazooie takes that to the extreme.
Yeah. Banjo-Tooie goes super crazy with
Banjo-Tooie is just nuts. Yeah. I mean, it's like you can jump from one level to another by going through a door.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like, wait, where the fuck am I?
Yeah, that world like kind of folds over on itself in really, really odd ways.
And it's real easy to get lost because of it. You just mm-hmm. wander around and suddenly you're in like, you're in the bay and you're like, what the hell?
Yeah. No, I completely agree with Torbjorn. To me, it's, you know, as much as there are many modern video games that I enjoy and appreciate a whole lot, but one of the things that I really miss about especially like the 64-bit era is the use of overworlds. And they were kind of every now and then you'd play a game like back in the GameCube days that had something like this. I think Skies of Arcadia was a really nice one, especially because it is a 3D overworld.
Oh, that game's overworld is just...
Yeah, you're in the sky.
Yeah, but that's an RPG. Really,
I get shivers from that game. It's still an overworld.
No, actually...
Yeah, sure, but RPGs always had overworlds.
That's not true. Actually, specifically in that era of like PS2, GameCube, Xbox One, a lot of even Japanese RPGs started coming out that didn't have overworlds, like Final Fantasy X. And even FF12... kind of doesn't have one.
Well,
it's like
well,
a bunch
like,
of smaller...
I mean, the game I'm playing right
like
now,
a bunch
Persona,
of Monster
you
Hunter
jump around
zones
some menu
strung
systems.
Together. So there's a lot of games, actually, where you kind of just kind of jump around with menus and, you know...
Johnny's got me want to play that game again for like the 43rd time.
I actually really appreciate that. It's also probably my single absolute favorite thing about Beyond Good and Evil, which is another game from the 128-bit era or whatever you want to call it. GameCube, PS2, etc. And I think the overworld in that game is small but wonderful. And the way you traverse it evolves over the course of the game. And so it always feels fresh. It always feels like you can go to new places. And there's lots of secrets. So it's very much worth exploring. It's like, for me, I've mentioned this before, it's the reason that Donkey Kong Country 3 is my favorite game in that series, because it actually has an overworld that you can explore and kind of move around freely on. And you get on all these different vehicles, like a little hovercraft and a jet ski, and you kind of go find these little caves and, you know, get bonus coins and stuff like that. I love that stuff. To me, that is kind of the magic sauce that really holds a game like that together. Even in a game where it's clearly just made up of a bunch of separate levels, you know, like a Donkey Kong Country or a Mario Galaxy, having something there to connect it all and having that thing be not just perfunctory, but actually have a lot of thought put into it and have it to be, like James said, it's like its own level. And yet that own level, it kind of has its own rules. Like there's stuff you can do there that you can't do in other places. And there's a certain sense of place that it gives the whole game. And that means a lot to me. And I place a very high premium on games that deliver that kind of thing. Diddy Kong Racing, I mean, I completely agree. That's the best thing about that game. And it's the reason that I've always felt that game was really kind of underrated and kind of brilliant. And I'm really sad that we never really saw another racing game kind of pull it off the same way.
I guess it depends on what mood I'm in. Sometimes I really wish for a menu when I'm forced to traverse, like vast stretches of land just to get to the next level. And
see, I think it really comes down to, do you manage that well? And I think a lot of overworlds don't manage it well, and that's the problem. Right.
Well, one of the reasons why Super Mario 64 works is because the castle ultimately is really, really small. But it's also confusing until you've played it enough.
Well, but Banjo-Kazooie's is huge, and it works too.
I have never played those games.
Jesus Christ. All right. next email. I'm going to get upset.
Okay. All right. Christian writes, does China save the Wii U or revitalize it? And given that the market is a complete black box, do you anticipate software specific to that market and what that might be? In other words, might China save the Wii U, but with software that no one else in the world wants? Also, given the state control of internet access in China, how do you think that might affect any of the consoles? Oddly enough, seems like Nintendo might be the best position for internet-less or internet-light play.
I don't understand the idea that all brick countries are created equal. Yeah, China's internet is super restricted. It is, but it's not like there's not digital store marketplaces in China. I mean, they do exist.
Okay. But what about online multiplayer games?
Those also exist in China. Now,
what they're doing now, I think that their latest stance is that they've allowed console games again, but anything that is considered anti-Chinese is banned.
Which is a lot of shit.
Which is Battlefield 4, mainly.
Yeah, oh yeah. Sure. Well, to be fair, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say nobody on this podcast is qualified to speak about the socioeconomic condition of the average Chinese video game player.
Yeah.
Not really.
It's outside even the most extended reaches of my purview.
Yeah. I will say, though, I think my first inclination was, well, maybe you'll be able to play online games if you can actually find a Wii U game that has online play. There's about five of them. But they're going to have to disable Miiverse or something like that, because clearly that's a sort of an uncontrolled social media thing. But then I thought, wait a minute, Miiverse is already heavily censored by Nintendo. All they have to do is submit to China's, guidelines on that stuff, which a lot of internet companies do. I mean, Google and Yahoo and, every major company like that already has a Chinese version of what they do.
Yeah, and Nintendo has already had that with the iPhone.
Yeah, which is, that was a long time ago. But
yeah, but that's not something they had to manage in real time.
No, but again, with Miiverse, they've already got the infrastructure set up to evaluate this stuff and make sure that, anything offensive gets pulled off, and maybe they add an extra layer of review before your posts appear online. But it seems like something they could work around, probably better than the other companies could. I think you'll have a hard time getting Xbox Live Gold set up in China just because it allows so much free communication and there's no one there to monitor all your voice chat, which is primarily the method of communication there. But with Miiverse, I think they might actually be able to pull that off if they're willing to put in the extra effort. And the market is just so massive. But to get to James's point, I think the question is whether any of these systems are really affordable enough to work in a Chinese market.
Well,
where
it's not even necessarily affordable. It's does the structure of how games are played online, is it conducive to – is the gameplay style conducive? Is the way that online games are experienced in China, is that –
is the game pricing conducive? I mean, where people are usually – they're mostly accustomed to playing free-to-play games in China.
Yeah, for the most part.
There is a strong-ish – I know that sounds derogatory, but it's it's a very insularly minded domestic video game producing market in China that produces games that are very much corely targeted at the internal Chinese national market.
Mm-hmm.
It is, on a quality standpoint, they are a different experience than what you would expect to get on a major console release out of one of the major console manufacturers. They, however, work on a completely different pricing model. They have a complete different, you know, policy on how they make their money. So there's a certain amount of culture shock in play here. It's not that Nintendo is unaware of how business operates in China. I mean, they obviously know what they're doing there. They operate businesses in China. They've operated sales in China before.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind that to operate in China, a lot of times you end up having to partner with a domestic company anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, that's really, I mean, I don't, there's no nice way to put it. It's a little bit graftish.
Hey, that's the case in Japan. I mean, you know,
to an extent, yeah.
That's why EA games are sold by, I think, Capcom or something in Japan.
In some cases, it does actually assist you in managing market expectations. I'm not sure that from a Wii U standpoint, it's the right decision for a platform to release. Keep in mind, these games aren't in Chinese. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have to be localized.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think, I mean, anything that Nintendo would release there is not going to be the Wii or the Wii U. It's going to be a console completely unique to that territory.
It's probably going to be a handheld. I would think 3DS is probably the first, you know, big salvo.
There already is a Chinese 3DS.
Oh, okay.
It already exists.
This was specifically consoles, like home, TV,
It is that the Chinese 3DS is the most region-locked 3DS ever.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Obviously.
And it's probably also, like, been hacked open so much.
Oh, it's terrible.
I bet you that, you know, I don't know. I don't know enough about China, and this market basically doesn't exist yet. So it's very hard to say, but, you know, I kind of doubt that China might be like the savior market for Wii U, but I do think Nintendo will probably find more success and sooner than either Microsoft or Sony. And at Microsoft, I would bet, doesn't even try, but I bet you Sony tries at least to sell like PS3s or something, in China, but I bet you Nintendo will do better because they are already more Asian centric in their, you know, their business practices and then the style of games that they have. And I'm not saying China and Japan are that much alike. I think culturally they're very, very different. But I think Nintendo is probably a little better positioned to find out what makes Chinese gamers tick and to make their system appealing to them. Whereas, although Sony is obviously also a Japanese company, they have become so westernized and so western focused, especially in the video game business, that I think it will be more difficult for them to kind of pivot and turn their stuff into Chinese friendly products. I think it's probably a little bit easier of a move for Nintendo to do. That's my guess. I mean, that's, you know, I'm pretty damn ignorant when it comes to that stuff, but that's just kind of my feeling is that Nintendo's probably, of the three big console makers right now, they're probably the best positioned to do that.
I don't know that anybody's positioned for it, to be honest. It
seems like they have the most to gain just because, you know, they're kind of in a bad spot right now. So
Sony has plenty to gain as well.
Sony's making, you know, probably the best-selling current console right now, and they haven't even launched in their home territory yet.
It's about money, though.
They're going to be good on PS4.
It's about that Skrilla.
Yeah.
The important metric to mind here is that all of these games would need... Well, there's a handful of games that have a Chinese localization. But they would need... Vast majority would need external localization into native Chinese. They would need a marketing strategy. They would need a console. I mean, there's so much infrastructure that needs to be built to introduce into a new market.
Do you think they need to come up with a whole Nintendo of China, or?
So it depends.
Some kind of local subsidiary. The other thing I was thinking is, you know, is it possible that the gamepad might have some cultural relevance there? You know, the same way that they thought that the gamepad would be hyper appealing to Japanese homes because they're smaller and they usually have only one TV, and in a family situation, you know, it might be hard to wrestle away the TV for playing video games. So they thought the gamepad might be, you know, kind of fit into people's lifestyles. I wonder if that might also be true in China, you know, at least similarly.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm just, I'm wondering.
I'm not up on the Chinese living conditions.
I'm not either. But it's, it seems,
I apologize.
Seems possible,
I'm not,
you know.
I need to watch more Frontline, apparently. I'm so sorry.
I need to watch that Red Dawn remake and pretend that they didn't CG over all the flags.
Oh, I've watched that Red Dawn remake. You're a stronger man than I if you can make it through that movie.
Yeah, I'm not even going to try. But yeah, clearly we are not qualified to talk on this topic. It's an interesting, you know, proposition. It's definitely going to be, you know, I wonder if in 5 years maybe it's just there's no legacy of console gaming in China, and so I wonder if it just never catches on. Like, it just, you can do it now, but no one's interested. They're too expensive. Nobody cares. They don't want to buy games. They only want to play free games, and maybe. It just never amounts to anything. Or maybe it really is like the new frontier and holy shit, you know, it's just a boom industry and somebody, whoever gets in there first and whoever does it the best, jumps in there and makes a $1 trillion. I don't know.
I would point you to the experience in another BRIC country of introducing consoles into Brazil, where there is a history of them.
Sort of, yeah.
There's
kind
already
of a cottage industry of consoles in Britain.
There is. There's a big import industry where they get shipped down from the U.S.
Yeah.
There's already a – obviously, I mean, it's a different flavor of Portuguese. But there's already a Portuguese version of a lot of these games.
Mm-hmm.
But there are very specific economic conditions on Atlantic-facing South American countries, especially Brazil and Venezuela, that make doing business in them incredibly difficult. And you have to deal with the cut in developing economy because there tends to be either no regulation or really specific and really complex regulation.
That really nasty import tariffs.
Very difficult. Yeah. So in Brazil's case, you end up paying basically 3 times the price of the console just because of tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but Microsoft has to pay that because Microsoft owns one tiny ass factory in Brazil. So they're completely exempt from all the import tariffs. So the PS4 costs 3 times as much in Brazil as an Xbox One. Because that's what Sony has to charge to get through the tariffs.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not going to be commensurate in China because obviously all of the major players have factories there. But there are these kinds of regulations in these countries where maybe their regulations are a bit more opaque. Maybe they're more fluid because of developing economy. Maybe they're more protectionist. There are things you have to manage that are going to require a certain amount of strategic rethinking. And it's like that going into any market. When Nintendo just got so tired of letting an affiliate run their South Korean branch, they had to just shut it down and figure out how to do business in South Korea.
Yeah.
And they did. It took them a couple years, but they have a fully functioning South Korean division of Nintendo now operating that makes them some amount of money.
Yeah, and but, you know, South Korea, I mean, we know more about that, you know, yeah, than China. You know, the average American, I think, knows a little bit more about Korea and the gaming culture in Korea. And it's the kind of place where you might think, well, you know, Nintendo probably won't do that great in Korea because the only thing people care about is StarCraft and MMOs. And, you know, they go to, people don't even own their own computers.
It's a very PC-oriented gaming culture.
They go to PC cafes, they go to internet cafes, and they play stuff there. And they don't necessarily want to own their own hardware, or maybe they can't afford to. And yet, you know, Nintendo found their niche and they're growing, and, you know, maybe one day it'll become a major market for them.
It was a big accomplishment for that division that they released Pokemon day and date with everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like a minor thing, but for them, for Nintendo, that was a big accomplishment for entering that marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It took them a couple years to get to the point where they were capable of pulling that off, but they did it. I think anytime they enter a new market, that's sort of the affiliate model probably is not going to work for them anymore. And I think at the same time, you have to be aware that doing this isn't something you just do overnight. It's a slow, deliberate process where you're going to make mistakes. And they may be costly mistakes, but you're not going to get it right the first time.
Yeah.
Because there's too much that can go wrong to do so.
So the answer is stay tuned. It might be a few years before we really know how this shakes out, but
it might be a few years before they really have a strategy. Mm. I mean, it's going to take some time. And they've been in that market before, but this is different.
Yeah, yeah. The IQ was specifically designed to get around a lot of the weird regulations and,
And piracy. And
yeah,
the rampant
and also,
piracy.
I don't think the IQ actually was very much of a success. You know, it was something they could point to and say, well, we tried. I mean, we did release a system in China, but I don't think it really ever did all that well.
It's bonkers.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was very, you know, specifically designed for anti-piracy because at the time that China was kind of known as a place where, you know, piracy was real bad. But of course, then again, you release a system that is impossible to pirate on and maybe people just don't buy it because that's
right.
That's a key feature for them is how easy is it to, for me to pirate stuff.
Well, if that were the case, the Dreamcast would have been a great seller in China. Yeah. Boom!
But it was illegal to sell it there, James.
That's true.
All right. Well, why don't we move on to the final email, and James is going to read this one.
So during CES, Sony released news about the PlayStation Now, their streaming service that will allow you to stream PS1, PS2, and PS3 games to phones, tablets, PS3, PS4, and Vita. What are your overall thoughts on PS Now, pricing structure, if and how it will affect PS Plus, and the digital download of retro titles today, and finally Nintendo's response to PS Now? Can we start off with, I'll believe it when I see it?
Well, let's start off with saying this email came from Tripon.
Oh, yeah, from Tripon. Yeah. Excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of those things that seems a little too good to be true until you try it for yourself. Definitely.
Well, yeah, okay. So I've seen videos or I've seen animated GIFs of, you know, like people who tested it on the show floor, and apparently the server was not very far at all. It might have been down the hall for all we know, and there was still a significant lag while playing
God of War. And that would have been a beta product, so you have to be fair on that point. But at the same time,
yeah.
I mean, there's a sense of like, okay, Sony's had this conversation with us as consumers before. This isn't PS Now. I mean, it came up during the PS4 announcement conversations. Like, will you be able to stream? They were discussing it in terms of Gaikai at that point.
Right.
And this is Gaikai.
This is Gaikai. But that's what they were, the terms they were using at the time. The PS Now is just rebranded Gaikai.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say what we said then, which is just like, all right, if you can pull it off, that's cool. It sort of goes back to the conversation we had when we were discussing what Nintendo's new console would be, which is, well, what's the future of the home console look like? Is it a streaming box? Because in theory, it could be. It could be a box where your game just streams back down. Those devices have already existed in the past with various levels of success. Even services like, what was it called?
OnLive?
GameTap.
GameTap, right.
Yeah,
GameTap was different, though, because you actually installed the games on
your hard drive. Some of the games did stream down, though.
Are you thinking of OnLive?
OnLive was the console that did it.
Yes.
Right.
And, I mean, it was, I did an OnLive demo at E3. You know, they said the server is located, I was like, Mountain View or somewhere. It's not far away, but it wasn't on site. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it worked. It was weird, and... It was mostly a psychological thing of like, I'm not really playing this locally. I'm playing this on a server somewhere, but right. It did work.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I wonder if we get to the point where this works well enough, fast forward like 10 years later and you have kids who just grew up with this kind of thing and they won't even understand the difference between streaming games and the way we play
there,
them.
For us, there is an obvious psychological barrier. Right?
Yeah.
I think we look at it and go, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, but I mean, if you had never seen it before and you were just, you know, playing a game like you would, you know, something on demand on Comcast, you know, it's, you know, movie, game, whatever, it's no difference.
Like, I see, like, if it worked...
Did they really call it V-game?
If it worked, I could see some advantages to it. For instance, you know, Nintendo is kind of reserving us the same ROMs that they've been selling us a couple of times, you know. If we could stream them on all their devices, they wouldn't need to constantly update their emulators. They wouldn't need to resell these ROMs to us, I guess. True. We would be kind of subscribing to the service.
Yeah.
and permanently, you know.
Yep.
So that could be cool, but the pricing would have to be really low.
And it wouldn't be.
Yeah, no.
I'm just going to say right now, it wouldn't
be. It'd be like $10 a month, I would say, probably.
But that's more
really?
Than Netflix.
Really? I mean, Nintendo probably thinks they can extort more than $10 a month out of their top level, as the term they use in digital platforms, their whales.
They're whales.
I just don't see myself paying more than, certainly not more than $10 for
how much
a service
do you pay,
like
how much,
that.
Guillaume, serious question. How much do you spend on virtual console games a month?
These days? Not very much at all.
Historically?
It varies so wildly. It depends on the releases. If they release a shit ton of games for this service, yeah, I'll be saving money.
Because otherwise, and Nintendo doesn't want you to save money.
Right.
So I think $10 a month is, you can want that, but
the thing is, a significant portion of the games that would be on the service would be games that they've emulated in the past, that they've sold me in the past, and that I've, you know, played fairly recently and don't really, you know, like that appetite has been satiated. I probably wouldn't pay again to play them again on newer hardware because I still have the old hardware. And I don't know. I'm very dubious about it. The thing is, like, this service from Sony could be cool if they were immediately releasing, you know, really hidden gems that cost $100 to import or to...
Or even just the, like, really popular games that you never played. That's the appeal of this. It varies widely from one person to the next because it depends on what you're familiar with or what you really want to try to catch up with, you know, from...
I guess... But the thing is, like, the really popular stuff, we've played some updated version, like an HD remake or a recent sequel recently.
I don't think
the appeal of playing God of War 3 on the PS4 is not all that
great. But what about playing God of War 3 on your Xperia Play?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I guess if I were to subscribe to that service, I would want... you know, obscure PS2. Like, I was trying to find... apparently, it's not expensive at all in the US, but in Canada, it's a bitch to find Romancing Saga for the PS2. I'm aware it's not supposed to be a very great RPG, but I can't find it. So if it were available on that service, yeah, of course, I would subscribe for at least, you know, 1 month or two, the time it took to actually beat it.
See, I think month-by-month subscriptions would actually be... disadvantageous.
Well, they're doing both. Now that's not to say that the same games will be available for per title rental versus subscription. And my guess is that there will be a breakdown there where the newest releases will probably be on a per title basis.
Newest retro releases.
Yeah. I think it will be kind of a combination of like Redbox and Netflix Instant. So the newer things or the more popular things will be, you know, like The Last of Us is not going to be included in the all-you-can-play monthly subscription. It will be, you know, pay $5 a week to play this or whatever. But then at some point when that game has been out on the service for long enough, it will maybe get moved over to the other one, and now it is part of the collective subscription. And then like the older stuff, like PS1 games that you're probably not going to pay per title to rent, that stuff will probably start on the subscription.
Well, yeah. They could be real smart about it and just have it set on automated adjustments based on, you know, usage. They could say, oh, this game's dropped below a certain threshold. Move it to the monthly subscriptions, or it's doing real well. Keep it in the pay area.
I could also see from Nintendo's point of view if they ever did something like this, and I kind of don't think they would do something exactly like this, but you know, maybe something similar at some point. I could see them maybe even doing it where, you get to keep, essentially you get to download or have access to maybe three games at a time. You mean like the old Netflix DVD subscriptions. So
yeah.
You get three games at a time. You play through those. When you finish one, you can send it back or, you know, basically release it and then choose another one. Or you can pay a more expensive subscription and get four or five at a time or something like that. Or maybe some of them you can even like, you know, maybe you pay a little extra and you can actually download that and just keep it forever on your system. So then it's almost even like Gamefly where you're renting game discs, but if you find one you really like, you can pay a little extra and just keep it, and then they'll just send you the next one off your queue. So there's...
That sounds like something completely different than what PlayStation Now is, though, because then they would need to create an emulator for whatever hardware you're using to play that game.
Well depends. Nintendo already does that, and they, you know...
Yeah. Okay, I know. Okay, so the assumption here is that they're going to be emulating the games for their current hardware.
It's still running on your device as opposed to running on a server.
Understood.
I have no interest in subscription then.
I think it's PlayStation Now doesn't make a ton of sense if you think of using your PS4 to get these games. Because you think, well, you know, on my PS3, I could potentially already play PS1 and 2 games on it. And, you know,
right.
And so then on PS4, being able to play PS1, 2, and 3 games on my PS4, it might be convenient, but it's not terribly impressive, maybe. And I don't really understand why they need this elaborate streaming architecture to do something that seems like technologically it's not all
because
that.
Because it's not about the PS4.
Exactly. So what's more interesting is being able to use a less powerful console, something like the Vita or even like your smart TV, like your Bravia TV.
Technically
you could say tablets, although I think most of these games would play so badly on tablets. They're not going to stop you, but you wouldn't want to play.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you could always sync a DualShock with it.
Maybe. Tablet. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe so.
You know.
I can see that, something. But I think something like
you would do that, I have no idea.
I think being able to play PS3 games on your Vita, is a lot more enticing. And then in the future, it'll be stuff like, they've even said they want to put this on other companies' hardware. And that's something that I don't think Nintendo would ever do. But, you know, Sony is a little more, gregarious with open standards.
Let's take the other option then. Let's say Sony went to Nintendo and said, look, we're willing to put our PS Now service out there. Would they do it?
Like, put a PS Now app on Wii U?
Yeah.
That is...
that would be pretty fucking ballsy.
That's mind-melding. I mean,
But I'm just... Like, would Nintendo allow it? Like, would they let them cross that bridge?
The sad thing is, it probably is technically feasible. Like that...
Oh, it absolutely would be technically feasible.
You could play PS3 and even PS4 games on your Wii U, which would be super crazy.
It's fucking madness. It's fucking madness.
Yeah, I don't think it would happen unless the companies like merged, which just seems equally unlikely, but.
Yeah, I'm just like, just to indulge the thought process.
It's fun.
Like,
it's a fun thought.
Could I play PlayStation 4 games on my 3DS? Because that sounds like something that's really fun.
You could play Vita games on your 3DS, which might, that might actually
work. Which
means
you're the only person playing Vita games.
Oh boy.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird play. That's the thing.
We've been
like,
so mean to the Vita today.
This thing is so such without boundaries technologically because it is using the video streaming that
is literally without boundaries.
You get into some really weird use cases, you know. And I think we've probably only scratched the surface. But
that's the thing. I just really wonder about like how much bandwidth it would chew up because
it's like streaming a movie, you know.
Yeah.
Plus,
well, it isn't though because you're having to send back your commands as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's more interactive than a movie.
Well, the stuff you're sending back is going to be pretty low, you know, low.
But
volume.
The latency's got to be real tight.
Yeah.
I
just don't know how well this would fly outside the U.S. where bandwidth is actually an issue.
Well,
actually,
the U.S. How well would this fly in parts of the U.S.?
The service will actually work better outside of the U.S. where their countries like Japan have far faster broadband. So it'll work extremely well, but no one will be able
Western
to
Europe,
afford it. Should
be fine,
it.
Yeah. But in fucking here, it's going to be.
I'm just looking at it from a cost standpoint. Places that have metered internet connections.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh okay. From that standpoint, yeah, he's right. So metered internet makes this way more.
Well, even like
possible.
Guillaume,
yeah.
You have metered internet, don't you?
I pay extra for unlimited.
Yeah.
Unlimited data.
Oh, I see.
I guess I'll start entertaining a Nintendo service of this kind once they have the technical capacity of broadcasting their Nintendo Direct at E3 without any hitch. Once they get over that hurdle, you know, maybe then we can entertain.
Well, don't worry,
because
when we get our live taped Nintendo Direct E3 press conference, this shit will be great. Jeez.
I think Guillaume just won this topic, and we should shut it down. But PlayStation Now is super fascinating. It's going to be quite an experiment. It'd be cool to see how it goes, I think. All right. Well, let's wrap up this episode.
Please.
Yeah, I know. Before we go, the email address is always rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We really appreciate everybody who writes in. We actually had a nice selection this week. Had a few extras. Maybe we'll catch up with them next time. But we love hearing from people. love seeing your questions and your ideas and your responses to what we talk about also. Of course, there's the talkback thread over there on the website over at NintendoWorldReport.com. We would love to get your reviews on iTunes, ratings and reviews there. If you use that service, it's very, very quick to do. And, it is a big help to the show. And, wanted to throw out our Twitter handles. We don't do that very often. My Twitter is at Johnny Metz with no H and no Z. James, what about you?
It's at NWR underscore James.
Mine is Guillaume NWR. Read the show notes to know how to spell Guillaume.
There's a G in there.
Yeah.
Just one.
Mine is Mr. Diamond J. MRDIAMONDJ.
The letter J. Yes. So follow us on Twitter. We actually, I was just thinking the other day, like, I don't think any of us has nearly as many Twitter followers as we have listeners to this podcast. And it's too bad because the things we talk about on Twitter are, you know, a lot of the same things we talk about on the podcast. So if you want more,
I pretty much
this,
tweet exclusively about games.
Yeah.
And sometimes social justice, but mostly games.
Yeah. I'm mostly games as well. Much to the annoyance of my family members and professional friends.
I'm games and basically complaining about Kanye West albums, but that's about it.
There we go. I don't even know what the fuck I tweet about anymore. It's just, it's just madness.
I don't understand most of James's tweets.
I was retweeting Japanese business articles earlier, so I don't know.
Yeah, so if you just can't get enough of this
shit's real weird on my Twitter.
This sparkling commentary, you can get a lot more of it over on Twitter.
Shit gets nuts in that party.
Yeah, and one last thing before we go. We have chosen the date, and it's going to be next Saturday. So Saturday, the 25th of January, we will be doing the live retroactive. We cleared it with Greg. We're all ready to go. I hope you have been playing F-Zero X and F-Zero GX in any way that you can. But we will be talking about those games. We'll be doing it live. We'll set up the page. There'll be a chat room. There'll be a Skype contact. You can call in, talk to us about F-Zero, and we'll have a lot of fun. So the exact time will be published a little bit later. So just please block out the day. It'll be roughly in the afternoon if you're in America, and then a little bit later than that over in Europe. And I think that'll cover the vast majority of our audience, but we're really looking forward to it, and I hope you will too. So we'll have that, and of course, as always, we will try to get a recording. So if you're not able to show up for the live event, we'll try to make sure that everybody gets to enjoy it a little bit after the fact. But if you're available that afternoon, come join us. We will have a really good time, and we'll talk about some damn racing games. I know I'm excited for that, and
God damn it.
It'll be great. So that's a stretch goal for our telethon, and it's a way for us to say thank you for everybody who donated and participated back in the telethon. So we'll look forward to that next weekend. I hope you will be able to join us, and until then, we will say goodbye.
Bye.
Later.
Yo.
Be down
I need
there with
to save
the water.
That clip somewhere and just replay it whenever.
Do it. I don't care.
It's a pretty hard.
It's a company that makes the majority
segment.
Of its money off Pachinko. They're not reputable. Pachinko doesn't even make sense.
But we're going to get Terranigma out of it, so.
We're going to get Terranigma with Pachinko is what you're going to get.
Everything
you're
going to
get
okay
Terranigma with the Pachinko experience.
Once you can play Terranigma on the gamepad, John, it'll put a band-aid over everything Nintendo is wrong
with
you.
Oh, my God. Except for the fact that your brain will just implode.
It's going to fix what ails you.
That Mode 7 overworld will soothe all
wounds. Will look like absolute garbage.
It's going to be beautiful.
It'll bring a lot of back
unredeemably terrible.
Dead.